Actually, we, and when I say we, I'm talking about my interpreter, Rafiki Ubaldo, who ended up becoming the co-author of the book as well. We would simply walk up and down the paths, dirt paths, up hills, and introduce ourselves to people and inform them what we were doing and ask them if they were interested in being interviewed. Of course, informing them that there was no obligation. If they chose not to, that was absolutely fine. And then asked them if they had any questions and went from there.
Where would you talk to them?
We talked to them from every place, from actually outside in the open, sitting under trees, to sitting in their homes, to sitting on their porches, to interviewing them in offices at the National University of Rwanda in Butare.
The accounts, the 11 accounts that are included in the book, you get the sense from talking to these survivors of the chaos that was going on in those 100 days, being told stay in your home, but that might be a trap. Being told go to this school or go to this place, but that might be a trap. There was no way to know how to stay safe.
No. In fact, that's a very interesting point, and it does indicate that these poor people really had no sense of what they should do to remain safe. One of the classic examples is that in prior instances, when the Hutu had attacked Tutsi, the Tutsi often went or fled to churches, and they found sanctuary there. They were safe there. What the Hutu did this time around is that they would tell the Tutsi to flee, to go to churches. And the reason they did that is that they knew that if the Tutsis went there, they would go there in the thousands, tens of thousands, and it would be a central place where the Hutus could go in and then slaughter them at will. And that happened over and over and over again. In fact, many of the memorials in Rwanda today are established at churches where thousands, tens of thousands of people were murdered on the grounds of the church.
There is one survivor you interviewed who saw many of her children killed, saw her husband killed. Then when she escaped with her life, she's then the victim of multiple rapes. Mm. Horrible experience. Mm. She breaks down crying during the interview.
She does.
And then you get up to leave. You think, and she says, no, don't go yet. I mean, she still wanted to talk.
She did, and it actually brings chills back to me, you mentioning that, because this happened repeatedly, actually. And several times she simply wanted us to sit there with her, and we would sit in silence. She needed somebody to be with her. There was nobody in the home at the time, even though two daughters survived. At another time, the same individual, the same woman, actually, as we got up to leave, asked us to hug her. And Rafiki and I both hugged her and then said goodbye and said that we would come back and see how she was doing the next day, which we did. Well, we ended up interviewing her approximately four times over the course of about a month, I think, because there were periods when she was busy. There were periods when Rafiki wasn't available. But almost each and every time, we ended up sitting with her after the fact because it was very brutal for her to relate this all over again, and you could tell that it was having a dramatic impact on her. And I was actually rather amazed that she continued to be interviewed, but she insisted.
Catharsis can't be the right word. It can't have enough, because some of the things we're talking about are so horrific. But do you think that people who did talk to you felt that they just had to tell somebody?
Some of them did. One woman in particular, actually it was the niece of the woman that we had talked about earlier who had lost her family members and who had been raped repeatedly. I met her niece in a small village up on the hillside, and about a year before, when I was doing some research on the Gachacha, I'd asked her if she would be willing to be interviewed about the Gachacha, and at that time she adamantly refused. And then we sat down, Rafiki and I sat down, we spoke with her about a half an hour just about life in general and about her experiences, taking no notes, and and asked her again, well, are you willing to be interviewed or not? And she said no. And so we left. Well, a year later, we were walking through this same village, a village called Huye, and we saw her and we waved to her. And I wasn't about to try to talk her into being interviewed again. She called us over and said that she wanted to be interviewed. And she said that the reason she hadn't wanted to be interviewed is because at the time her family was being threatened by Hutu, and her husband was a member of the Gachacha, and it was a very dangerous situation. She was very depressed. But this time around, she asked us if she could be interviewed. I think you're right. It's not catharsis, certainly, because the trauma is too deep. But there was a need to at least speak to somebody about it, because oftentimes these individuals are very isolated in their communities.
Yeah. Did you get the feeling that the survivors thought or knew if the rest of the world cared or knew of the genocide?
Well, that came up over and over again. People were very honest, forthright, and angry about the fact that Rwandan, the Tutsis, had been left to be slaughtered. They were always also almost all of them were aware that Bill Clinton had arrived in 1999 and got off a plane apologized to the people of Rwanda. Many of them accepted that. And I found that very curious, and I asked them about that. I said, well, look, you know, in the West, Clinton has been criticized for, not allowing his State Department to even use the word genocide during the perpetration of these crimes. Second, he instructed his personnel at the UN to vote against expanding the UN mission that was already there. And third, ever since that point in time, at least up until 99, there had been no apology. And then when he got there, he went down on the tarmac but didn't go into the city, didn't meet people, simply made the apology, got on the plane and left. Now, what people told me was, number one, they appreciated the fact that at least one leader from Western country had the guts or the decency or to come and apologize. Very few, if any, others had done that. Secondly, they appreciated the fact that there's now a Clinton Foundation that is putting millions of dollars into assisting victims of AIDS, and they greatly appreciated that. But what they did say to me is they would not be surprised if there was another genocide there, and if another genocide took place, they wouldn't be surprised if they were left high and dry again.
When you would conduct the interview, generally three of you in the room, you, Rafiki, and the interview subject?
Right. Generally three of us. Sometimes a family member would sit in.
And so I know that some of the interviewees spoke English, so you wouldn't need a translation. But if you did need Rafiki, I'm wondering about him because he is a survivor. And then he hears the story, a particularly harrowing story about people who were captured and told, if you get us a goat, we'll shoot you quickly. But if you don't, you will suffer. And so you had these people who knew their fate was sealed, but they were still rushing around to try to get the goat so they could be. He would hear that story. Then he would have to tell it to you. This had to be so hard on him.
It was hard on him. Quite frankly, I'm not sure how he did it. Rafiki, interestingly, up until this point in time and about halfway through this process, had never told me about his experiences during the genocide period. He would allude to certain things, but he would not go into any detail at all. About halfway through this, one evening, we were sitting in my room in Kigali, and all of a sudden, it just spilled out of him. And it was almost as if he had to tell me what he experienced after listening to a lot of these stories. But going back to the interview process, I would ask him over and over and over again if he was all right, and we would stop. And he would emote in his own ways. I mean, I tried never to emote because it was hard enough interviewing the individuals. And if I felt that if I showed through tears or crying that they would as well, and it would just complicate things. But so Rafiki, we had the understanding that if my voice went quiet, if I didn't say anything, that's when I was emoting within myself, and Rafiki was not to push me. We would just sit there. The same, and we had this the agreement along the same lines for Rafiki. So if all of a sudden he went quiet, I wouldn't say, "Well, Rafiki, could you ask the question again?" Or "Rafiki, what's wrong?" I automatically knew. We also had the agreement that when it got to a point where Rafiki couldn't go on, if there was such a point, and there were many times, we would end for the day. And we also had the agreement that if he needed to take days off, and he did, that would be absolutely fine, because I did realize that he was bound to relive what he had experienced, and not only what he had experienced, but what he had witnessed, what he had heard. And yeah, it was extremely difficult. I ended up actually having four different interpreters over the period of time. Part of it was Rafiki was back in Sweden. I was on a Fulbright, and so I had three other individuals who served as interpreters. But all four of them, the three plus Rafiki, all of them were survivors. And they all reacted in different ways in regard to conducting these interviews and assisting me.
Obviously, there's nothing that can be done to make up for the horrific crime that is genocide. But if you have someone like Eva Kaur, who just spoke in Fort Smith and was a survivor from Auschwitz, Ali Wiesel, who's coming to Fayetteville, the people who talk to you, can that in any way do anything to help healing or to help stop another genocide before it happens?
That's an excellent question. Relate this more to my interviews with the people in Darfur than I can Rwanda, because the interviews with the people in Darfur or the refugees from Darfur have been more recent. And those people are still in refugee camps. And I can't tell you how many times I've been told by individuals thanking me for being in these camps and caring about what was happening to them, and caring about the fact that Darfur was still under siege, and the people saying, you know, we have no hope here, and your presence, and obviously the presence of humanitarian aid workers and other researchers, they say give them hope. Now, the more recent incident that I've been involved in is in the Nuba Mountains in Sudan. And I really do think that these individuals who speak about it or speak out about it do help to raise the awareness of what genocide is for the individuals and what it means for them to be left totally on their own and with no help from the international community. And what I'm seeing in regard to the Nuba Mountains, and right now there are approximately, it's estimated, 200,000 people up high in the mountains and caves living without food. The rate of malnutrition has already hit 13%, and these people may end up starving to death, which would be a repeat of what they experienced at the hands of the government of Sudan in the 1990s when thousands starved to death. But my point is that there seems to be, at least among scholars and human rights activists, a real focus early on in regard to the Nuba Mountains. So my sense is that there is this anti-genocide movement is growing in this country and in Europe. And I think that these stories and the witnessing by the Elie Wiesels and other survivors contribute to this awareness and the need to act early on.
I'm curious. You're someone who studies genocide, writes about genocide, interviews people who have survived genocide. You hear horrific stories. Put that against what is relatively speaking, international ambivalence at times. Do you remain an optimist? Are you an optimistic person?
That's an outstanding question. And to be honest, I waver back and forth. I have my dark, dark days when I feel that nobody really cares, that all of the work that I've done, for example, has been an absolute waste of time. But then again, and I'll give you the example of yesterday, which was rather remarkable. I got a telephone call from Nairobi from my interpreter who interprets for me in the Nuba Mountains. He called me. Then last night, I got a call from Cornell University, a professor of history, John Weiss, who called me and wanted advice in regard to what we should do right now in regard to the Nuba Mountains to get the Obama administration and the UN focused on it. And I received I received another letter from actually some folks here in Fayetteville. I gave a talk for the Retirement Association, and several wrote and told me how moved they were, and that the letters to the editor that I write, et cetera, at least help to inform people. So I mean that. So I swing from optimism to pessimism. And right now, that's particularly so because these 200,000 people are up in the mountains suffering, and they're being denied humanitarian aid. And there's talk of opening a corridor, but that talk has been going on for a month. And so I often say, it seems to be talk, 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 and no action. And that's what really gets me. And I have to tell you, that's what spurs me on in a sense, and that's what's moving me to go to the Nuba Mountains next month, even though there is a war going on. And not to sound dramatic or anything like that, but I realize this time around it could be my demise, because I am going through an area that's been cut off. I'm going in with the rebel groups, which are obviously a target of the government of Sudan. And yet I feel compelled to go up into the mountains and see what the situation is, because I know what these people went through last time. They ended up eating. They became so desperate and ran out of grasses and leaves of trees. They began digging up roots that they knew were poisonous to eat those. Now, they would boil them 3 and 4 times, and they would mash them and they would dry it. But there were still babies and the elderly who were dying from eating that stuff. And I feel, you know, one only does so much writing about it after the fact. I want to get up there and with a computer, and I want to send contemporary reports back in the hope that somehow, some way, it does some good. And if it doesn't, I'm sure I will come back rather pessimistic again.
Sam, thanks as always.
Thank you.